Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live, not live, recorded on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking with one of the most noted American foreign correspondents of the recent years, Stephen Kinzer, formerly of the New York Times, who's written a new book, Overthrown, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. We'll be discussing this book with Kinzer and the state of foreign correspondents in the world today, on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson. The tens of millions of dollars spent by the phone and cable companies to begin the process of privatizing the internet has so far been money well spent, as the process got underway in the House of Representatives on the evening of June 8th. Majorities voted to defeat amendments to a larger telecom reform bill that would have preserved the principle of network neutrality. Democrat Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who led the failed campaign to save internet freedom in the House, knew the odds were not in his favor from the outset.
We want to have a debate on net neutrality. All the Republicans are willing to give to the proponents of net neutrality the central constitutional protection built into the internet for the last 20 years is 10 minutes. That is a disgrace.
The 20-minute debate, featuring 10 minutes for each side, was feisty. Opponents of the creation of internet speech, stratified by your ability to pay, put up a valiant fight. But they were bum-rushed by lawmakers well-marinated in telco and cable cash and not afraid to twist the facts of the debate to the point of outright lies, resulting in a well-oiled choir all singing out of the same phone books and cable guides. Like the bill's main sponsor, Joe Barton, Republican from Texas, who denied the very essence of the dispute.
We're debating a term of net neutrality that didn't exist 9 months ago.
New Jersey Republican Mike Ferguson cribbed from the still proliferating AstroTurf groups that have been set up to muddy the issue.
Congress's hands-off policy has allowed the World Wide Web to prosper by having the market pick winners and losers.
Texas Republican Lamar Smith provided the refrain,
"Reject government regulation of the internet,"
which was echoed by Nebraska Republican Lee Terry.
"Let's not regulate the internet today."
Tennessee Republican Marsha Blackburn set the hype machine to overdrive.
"The next thing is going to be having a Secretary of Internet Access. I don't believe that's somewhere we want to go."
Joined by Texas Democrat Gene Green.
"Higher prices for the consumers, while large internet content providers get a free ride."
And fellow Texas Democrat Charlie Gonzalez, who actually accused the supporters of internet freedom of ganging up on the poor, mistreated telcos and cable providers.
"It is driven by a hostility against one particular business entity that is involved and is a stakeholder in the internet. It is unfair when this body takes sides."
And then there was Illinois Democrat Bobby Rush, who a few years back secured a $1 million donation from the SBC Foundation for a technology center to be built in his name in his Chicago area district. A co-sponsor of the omnibus telecom reform bill, Rush sung the praises of non-existent protections to network neutrality and argued against preservation of the principle.
"This is a good bill. This is a marvelous bill. This is a bill that's worthwhile."
Later in the debate, Rush was called upon again to defend the drive to do away with free speech online.
"This is a good bill. This is a great bill. This bill will go a lot, will do a lot, go a long way."
While the vote in the House is history, California Democrat Zoe Lofgren does not believe the fight is anywhere near over.
"When the public finds out what we are doing to their internet, the dome is going to collapse with the uproar that creates.
According to a cursory review of the campaign finance information archived at the nonpartisan opensecrets.org, all of those quoted here have collectively raked in more than $615,000 in direct political donations and contributions to their reelection funds from just the major phone and cable companies and the trade associations that do their heavy lifting in Washington. This just counts the money that's exchanged hands so far in the 2005 and 2006 election cycle alone, and does not count additional contributions made to individual leadership political action committees, those slush funds politicians use to spread cash around among friends. Of the windfall we added up on a whim, 84% of it went to those who opposed network neutrality. Not bad for a night's work. Keep in mind, every representative is up for re-election in November. In the Senate, the principle of network neutrality will be the subject of another Senate Commerce Committee hearing later this month, and there's already strong bipartisan support there for a piece of legislation called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, which may now be the last hope to keep the net as we know it. Visit SaveTheInternet.com to learn much more about this upcoming battle. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, June 11th, we have as our guest Stephen Kinzer, American author and newspaper reporter who came to prominence during the 1980s covering Central America for the New York Times, but has been a longtime foreign correspondent and been in all corners of the world covering U.S. foreign policy and international politics. Stephen Kinzer has a new book out, Overthrown, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, just published in April of this year, that's already drawn considerable attention. Stephen Kinzer, thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Great to be with you.
Well, just to cut to the chase on your new book, Overthrown, what's the core argument of the book?
As the title, Overthrow, makes clear, what I'm talking about is the U.S. policy of overthrowing foreign governments. Now, when President Bush announced the invasion of Iraq in 2003, many people in the U.S. and I think around the world saw that as a dramatic moment when the United States was ripped away from a long tradition of cooperative diplomacy and plunged into a new era in which it would forcibly overthrow foreign governments. What I'm trying to say in my book is that that's wrong, that the United States has been overthrowing governments for more than a century. In my book, I look at the 14 times the United States has done this, the 14 times the U.S. has overthrown a foreign government. And for each of these overthrows, I ask three questions. The first question is, what happened? How did we overthrow this particular government? Second question is, why? Why did we do it? And the third question is, from the perspective of history, from the perspective of today, what has been the long-term effect of each one of these overthrows? So by considering these overthrows of foreign governments not as a series of unrelated episodes, but rather as one long continuum that stretches over more than 100 years of American history, I'm able to tease out some patterns and draw some conclusions that aren't really clear when you only study these individual episodes and not look at them all together.
Well, one of the things in the book you talk about early on that emerges in the book is what the explanations are for why the United States overthrows governments around the world over the past 100, 110 years. And is it fair to say that these overthrows rarely represent sort of grassroots upsurge of popular opinion of the people of this country demanding we overthrow governments, that there are other factors that are involved?
In most cases, the U.S. has left countries in worse shape than they were before we overthrew their governments. We have a very short-term time frame. We look at our short-term goals very impatiently. We want to achieve them. We have the military power to achieve them. But then we are not prepared for the long-term consequences. One of the patterns that certainly comes through when you study all these episodes is that in the end, they usually wind up very badly for both the target country and for the United States. Now, you ask about the reasons why we do this.
Yeah, I sort of was meaning to get to the domestic explanation for why the U.S. Has gone after 14 different governments.
There is a pattern, and of course the pattern doesn't apply to all 14, but it does apply to most of them. And this is the pattern that I noticed as I was researching each of these 14 cases. It's sort of a three-step process. The first thing that happens is that the government of some foreign country challenges or bothers or harasses or taxes or expropriates some big foreign company. That's what gets the U.S. government first involved. So the owners of this company, which has been forced to suddenly pay taxes, or now it's got to follow labor regulations, or it has some other problem with this government, the leaders of these businesses come to Washington, and they complain that the leadership in a certain country where they're working is bothering them, is undermining them, is harassing them. So that's step one. The business motive, the economic motive, is the beginning of it. Without this challenge of American businesses by some nationalist leader in another country, that country does not even get onto the radar screen in the White House. It doesn't come into the U.S. crosshairs at all. So that's the first phase. Now, the second phase is what happens inside the White House, in the U.S. policy process. And that is where the motivation for these overthrows transforms a bit. Presidents of the United States do not overthrow foreign governments just to protect individual American companies. But what they do is convince themselves or allow themselves to be convinced that any government that would bother or tax or harass or expropriate or otherwise challenge an American company must be anti-American, anti-democratic, repressive, evil, and probably the tool of some foreign power that wants to undermine the U.S. So the motivation morphs from an economic one to one that might be described as a political or a geostrategic one. That's stage two. Stage three comes when it's time for American leaders to justify their actions, to explain to Americans and to people around the world why they did it. And then they use a different explanation. They don't refer to the economic problems, and they rarely even refer to political problems. Instead, they present these interventions as rescue missions, liberation of oppressed people from a brutal clique of oppressive leaders. This is actually an argument that plays very well in the U.S., I think, for two reasons. First of all, Americans are very compassionate people. It truly does disturb us, I think, to hear that people in other countries are suffering or are oppressed. And secondly, of course, we're innocent and naive and ignorant enough to believe that we can easily go over there and fix the situation just by getting rid of a few people at the top of the government. So those are the three different phases. The interventions start because of a problem that American business is having. Then the fact that the companies are having a problem is transformed into the belief that that government that's creating those problems must be anti-American and anti-democratic. And third, the American people are told that the reason we're doing this is only to liberate people who are only just waiting for our forces to arrive.
Now, the question that jumps out to me in a program called Media Matters, to an author who's also a working journalist, is what role have the news media played, if you can generalize, during these 14 overthrows to sort of alert the American people to the first two factors and get their attention off the third factor, which go with these invasions?
The role the U.S. press has played is quite considerable, but it's not the role that you've pointed out, unfortunately. The press has been remarkably reluctant or unable or unwilling to investigate the backgrounds of these operations before they happen. Afterwards, there's often a lot of hand-wringing and investigation about what went on before. But there is often a sense in the American press that the press is part of the team. We are the American press, but we're more American than press. We are on the side of the government, and therefore we wouldn't want to say anything or do anything or print anything that would undermine plans that our government leaders have. So this is something that has been repeated throughout many of these interventions. I give you just one example. In 1954, the U.S. overthrew the government of Guatemala. Now, we were portraying that government as a brutally repressive, communist-oriented regime. The New York Times sent a correspondent down there, and he started writing stories saying that this wasn't the case at all, that, in fact, this was just a nationalist regime. It was bothering the United Fruit because of United Fruit's oppressive position in Guatemala, and that the steps taken against United Fruit in Guatemala had the support of a huge majority of the population. Well, this was not the kind of reporting that the American government wanted to see in the U.S. press. So the director of the CIA went out to lunch with the business manager of the New York Times, and after that conversation, that correspondent who was in Guatemala filing those inconvenient reports was quickly removed. So those are cases of inaction, but I think there are also some cases where the press has actually promoted these invasions and served as kind of the handmaiden of the U.S. government. I can think of two very obvious cases. One was in 1898 in Cuba. That was when the press engaged in a very shameful and very intense campaign attempting to portray Spanish rule in Cuba, which had been going on for centuries without much complaint from anyone in the U.S., as incredibly brutal, cruel, oppressive, and bloody. And that reached the peak with the blowing up of the battleship Maine, the American battleship, in the harbor of Havana, Cuba. Now, that explosion led to huge headlines in the U.S. press. In fact, it's such an interesting episode that I have in my book reproduced the front page of the New York Journal the day after the ship was exploded. It says, Maine was destroyed by an enemy's infernal machine. And there was a big headline offering a huge reward for finding which Spanish soldiers had been involved, and even a diagram on the front page of how the Spaniards attached the mine to the side of the Maine and blew it up, killing hundreds of our soldiers while they slept. It was not until 75 years later that the Navy ordered an inquiry under Admiral Hyman Rickover, and that inquiry turned up the fact that the Maine had not been destroyed by a mine at all, and that actually it was blown up by a spark inside the engine room. So that only became clear much later. Flash forward a century now to the Iraq War, and I think weapons of mass destruction play the role that the Maine played in the Spanish-American War. That was the argument that was supposed to clinch our justification for invading. It was an argument that turned out not to be true, just like the Spanish blowing up of the Maine. But as in the case of the Maine, it was an argument that the press swallowed. The press bought it. The press didn't really challenge it until it was far too late. So I think those are examples of how the press not only can cheer on and help and encourage these interventions by its inaction, by its refusing to examine the factors behind them, but can actually, in some cases, act in a definitive, aggressive way to stir up the American public to want to push for these overthrows.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Stephen Kinzer, the longtime foreign correspondent, mostly for the New York Times, who's written a brand new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. We're recording this show a couple weeks before we're going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax. Let us do the talking. Stephen Kinzer, just so we can get clear on this, could you give a little more information on your background that led you to write this book?
I spent the 1980s, as you mentioned earlier, working in Central America. I covered the Sandinista conflict with the Contras during the 1980s. I also spent a lot of time in Guatemala and covered the terrible violence that was shaking that country. That experience naturally led me to ask myself some questions about these countries. Instead of just covering them on a day-to-day basis, what just happened in yesterday's battle or who died, I tried to pull back a little and ask myself, why are these countries in such conflict and such poverty? And in both the cases of Nicaragua and Guatemala, I discovered that it was U.S. intervention, actually the overthrow of the government by the order of a U.S. president, that pushed these countries into the hell in which they're now living. So I decided in both cases that I would write a book about these countries in which I would try to explain the whole background of U.S. intervention and what happened and why and what the results were. So I did that. I wrote a book about Nicaragua some years ago and also a book about Guatemala. And for a time, I was pretty satisfied with myself that I had really shown the cultural and political and economic background of this particular intervention and what all of its effects had been. But then, after a while, I began to realize that I hadn't pulled back far enough, and that to study these interventions individually, no matter how intensely and fully you study them, was to miss part of the point. Part of the broader point here is that the U.S. has been doing this over a period of more than 100 years, and that the only way to understand these operations is to study them all together. And I've come to believe from the experience of writing this book that it's not possible to understand modern history or the 20th century history of the United States or what's happening in the world today without understanding this long history the U.S. has of overthrowing foreign governments.
Now, Stephen Kinzer, you break down the 14 overthrows into three phases, one sort of early phase, pre-Cold War, what you call the imperial phase, then during the Cold War era, the coup d'etat phase, and now I guess the resurgent giant phase. I don't know what you call it, the third phase, the current regime we're in after the end of the Cold War. Why don't you just walk us through these phases? Then I want to talk specifically about some of the overthrows.
The Americans first got really interested in overthrowing foreign governments and projecting power around the world at the very end of the 19th century. There were a number of reasons for this. Of course, the frontier had been declared closed in 1890. The U.S. Census Bureau announced that there was no longer any room to settle in North America. At the same time, American business and agribusiness were both becoming tremendously efficient, and our factories were churning out huge amounts of materials and goods, and the farms were producing so much. There was a great search for new markets, and there was a great search for new resources. So all this together combined to push America to look abroad during the 1890s, let's say. So in that period, we overthrew the government of Hawaii first, then in the Spanish-American War, the governments of Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines. And then a little bit later, after the first decade of the 20th century, two governments in Central America, Nicaragua and Honduras. Then in the Cold War...
Before you go, just real quickly, Don, these invasions or these overthrows were more often actual military invasions?
Exactly. This was a time when the U.S. could act quite openly in world affairs. We didn't have to hide what we were doing, and nor did we ever try to. Our actions in all those countries I just mentioned, or in most cases, were quite clear, quite open, quite public. By the time the Cold War came, that wasn't possible anymore. Why? Because there was a new factor in the world. That was the Soviet Union. There was a sort of counterbalancing power in the world to the U.S., so it wasn't possible for the U.S. to send troops to invade foreign countries, or, as in the case of Nicaragua, what we did in 1909 was simply send a letter to the president telling him, we've had it with you, you're fired. That wasn't possible anymore in the Cold War because it could have provoked a response from the Soviets, and that could have spiraled out of control into some nuclear holocaust even. So we had to find a new way to overthrow governments, and that is when the CIA emerged as the instrument that presidents used to overthrow governments covertly. We did that four times. In 1953, the first CIA overthrow was carried out in Iran. A year later, we did the same thing in Guatemala. Then in 1963, the CIA overthrew the government of South Vietnam. And then in 1973, the government of Chile. Now, just as a very interesting side fact about these four coups, and I think I might have been the first person to discover this, because you wouldn't notice this unless you had studied all these four coups together. It was that in each of these four cases, so Iran, Guatemala, South Vietnam, and Chile, the CIA station chief in the country, supposedly our biggest expert on that country, told the government in Washington, don't do this. This is not going to work. This is going to have terrible effects. And in each of those four cases, instead of listening to their CIA station chief, the presidents and secretaries of state and CIA directors fired them and sent in new people who could be relied upon to promote these interventions. So it's, in a way, not fair to blame the CIA for them. In fact, CIA top official in each of these four countries was against the coup. So that was the second era, the Cold War. And then we flash into the modern era. With the disappearance of the Soviet Union, it has become possible to go back to Plan A. We are now able to invade countries openly again, and we've done that four times in Grenada, Panama, then, of course, in Afghanistan and in Iraq.
You know, just this last point you made about being able to invade countries openly again begs the question immediately, what about international law? Because the United States invariably invokes international law against some countries, yet it would seem that invading other countries or overthrowing their governments violates international law usually, doesn't it?
Right now, the Bush administration has taken the position that the U.S. is not bound by any of the foreign treaties we've signed, that they are indications of desires, but they don't have the force of law. This is a very radical new concept that I don't think any American president or administration has ever advanced before.
So,
nonetheless,
yeah, but in the previous 13 overthrows or the more recent overthrows prior to the invasion of Iraq, what was the U.S. position vis-a-vis international law?
I think in those cases, the U.S. Did not follow international law, certainly, but at least didn't make a big pretense of dismissing the whole idea of international law. One of the underlying factors that has allowed Americans to support and promote these interventions over such a long period of time is a view that I think is still prevalent in the Bush administration, and that is that when we overthrow a government for our own interest, it's also in the interest of that country, in the interest of the world, and in the interest of peace, because what's good for the United States is good for everybody. This is a rare view. There aren't very many countries in the world that would be so self-centered as to believe this. But I think there's one big difference between Americans and people in other countries in this regard. And we don't like to be told or to believe that we're doing anything in our own interest. Now, for example, I used to live in Turkey for a while, and in Turkey the army would sometimes cross the border into northern Iraq to go and attack hideouts of Turkish guerrillas that were hiding in northern Iraq. Now, this was illegal because, of course, an army was crossing a border. And when the Turks were asked, why are you doing this, they would explain, well, we're doing it because it's in Turkey's interest. It's for us. If we don't do something for Turkey, nobody else will. And the Turks will buy this. Other countries are the same way. Why are the French so involved in the South Pacific and conducting nuclear tests there? Well, they say, c'est pour la France. It's in France's interest. France acts in France's interest, and the French people are fine with that. Only Americans do not want to hear this argument. They don't want to hear that we ever did anything for our own interests. On the contrary, we feel and we want to make ourselves believe that we are actually sacrificing in order to help these other countries. And the suggestion that we would be overthrowing foreign governments only because it's good for us, for our economy, or for our political or strategic interests, is something we don't want to hear. And that's why we love to hear our leaders tell us that we are only carrying out these operations out of selfless charity to help poor suffering people in other places.
We're talking to Stephen Kinzer today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Stephen Kinzer is the author of the brand new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. This is a wonderfully written book. I urge you all to pay careful attention to it and read it if this is an area that interests you, and I think it ought to be if you're listening to this program. And again, this is a pre-recorded show. Please don't call in. Let us do the talking, and there is a great deal to talk about. Stephen Kinzer, I'd like to go to that Cold War phase for a while. This is the era I grew up in, and I remember the last of the overthrows, the last two, fairly well. And you have a nice discussion there of John Foster Dulles. And I think we can share a little bit of that with our listeners. He's a very fascinating person.
I agree with you. Dulles was the Secretary of State under President Eisenhower in the 1950s. I've come to conclude that he really was one of the key figures in shaping the second half of the 20th century. He had a remarkable combination of backgrounds that made him into a very extraordinary figure. And as you say, I devote a number of pages in my book to trying to describe this. Very briefly, these are some of the threads of his background. First of all, he came out of a background of great privilege. His family traced its lineage all the way back to Charlemagne. His grandfather had been Secretary of State. His uncle had been Secretary of State. So he moved very easily in the corridors of power when he was still in his early 20s. His grandfather arranged for him to have various diplomatic postings and go on. He was at the Versailles Conference after World War I, for example. So he got to know presidents and plutocrats and bankers all over the world. Second thing is that Dulles came from a very religious family. His father was a clergyman. His mother's father had been a missionary in India who was buried over there. He had to go to church every day and all day Sunday when he was young and memorize Bible verses and Psalms, and for a while even considered becoming a clergyman himself. So he really developed this view that the world is locked in a confrontation between good and evil, and believed that those countries in the world that believed in Christianity and capitalism were in a constant and inevitable war with all other countries. The third aspect of Dulles' background, which may have been the most important, is that by the time he became Secretary of State, he had already spent several decades as the most highly paid corporate lawyer in America. He represented almost every giant American multinational corporation, from United Fruit all the way to International Nickel. His clients were digging for oil in Brazil, selling insurance in the Soviet Union, digging ports in all over Africa. So he was deeply involved in world affairs from an economic point of view. That was the way he saw the world, as a place for business. So when he came into office, he was a militant anti-communist, and partly because of his religious background, and I think, and he believed that the U.S. should not have any contact, much less negotiate, with the Soviet Union or any communist country. He was against, for example, all cultural exchanges with communist countries. He was against allowing American journalists to visit China. He actually was opposed to any agreement between the United States and any communist country because he believed that this could only be a ruse designed to force us to let our guard down and not realize how they actually wanted to come over and kill us all. So he had a very Hobbesian view of the world, that the world was just full of enemies that were all focusing on the United States. And it was this combination of views that allowed Dulles to believe that when a leader of a country in the developing world tried to take control of the resources in his own country, he was not being a nationalist. He was not responding to a domestic challenge or a domestic problem. He was undoubtedly acting as a conscious agent of international communism. And that is the accusation that he made against leaders like President Arbenz in Guatemala, who had his problem with United Fruit. He saw the world in economic terms, and he saw any government that would challenge an American company as an implacable enemy.
Stephen Kinzer, our guest today here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're discussing his new book, Overthrow: America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Now, under Dulles, the CIA, as you pointed out, overthrew the popular and, as far as I know, fairly democratic governments in Guatemala and Iran, and led to much further problems, as you point out in the book, down the road in both of those countries. Today, we're hearing drumbeats again toward Iran. Reading your book, one would be led to believe that the claims the Bush administration is making about Iran should be taken very skeptically.
Iran is a great example for the point I'm making, that these interventions in the long run come back to haunt us. Let's take a look at what happened in Iran. So in the late 40s and early 50s, the winds of nationalism were blowing through Africa and Asia and Latin America, partly because of the inspiration of Franklin Roosevelt and his speeches during World War II. In Iran, nationalism meant controlling oil, the Iranian oil industry was totally owned by one foreign company, and the Iranians got almost nothing for all the oil that was pumped out from under their soil. Meanwhile, they were a wretchedly poor country. So it was their great desire to nationalize their own oil industry and to use the profits for development of their own country. It was this desire that carried Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh to power in the early 50s. Mossadegh was sort of the incorporation of this view that Iran needed to take control of its oil industry, with the approval unanimously of both houses of the Iranian parliament. Mossadegh decreed that nationalization that set in motion a series of events that led the CIA to come into Iran in the summer of 1953 and overthrow him. Now, today we can hardly think of using the word Iran and the word democracy in the same sentence, but the fact is Iran was a functioning democracy in the early 1950s, and Mossadegh was probably the greatest leader this country has produced in many centuries. So we overthrew him. Then what happened? We put the Shah back on his throne. The Shah ruled for 25 years with increasing repression. His repression led to the explosion of the late 1970s, the Islamic Revolution. That revolution brought to power a clique of fanatically anti-American clerics who have spent the last 25 years intensely and sometimes very violently trying to undermine American interests. Now we are facing a great crisis with Iran over its nuclear ambitions. But this religious regime would never have come to power. This nuclear crisis would never have emerged if the United States had refrained from invading or from overthrowing the government of Iran in 1953. It was that episode that set all these processes in motion. This is a great example of how these interventions and overthrows of foreign governments seem successful at first, but with the passage of time, you come to see how disastrous they are. That's why I think this book I've written probably could not have been written in an earlier age, because we have had to wait and watch and see how all these interventions have gone so badly. Now, if we look at Iraq, you see that with the revolution in the internet and communications, the time frame has been greatly compressed. In other places, it took years or decades for us to realize that overthrowing this particular government really wasn't such a good idea and hasn't worked out the way we thought. Now, we get to find that out much more quickly.
In the case of Iraq, I recall 3 years ago during the build-up to the war that when anti-war critics would suggest that the reason we were interested in invading Iraq and overthrowing the government was that there was so much oil under the land of Iraq, that point was shouted down as being absurd and hysterical and completely out of order, to the point that many people who were against the war didn't make that as an issue. They just sort of felt self-conscious, like they were being some sort of conspiratorial nuts to raise that as an issue.
You're right, and it's very odd because common sense tells you that if Iraq did not have any oil, we would never have overthrown its government. Now, that may not have been the only reason we did it, but certainly that was a very important part of it. It reminds me of a time when I went to see the Dalai Lama speak, and somebody got up to ask him why the U.S. or the CIA had not tried to help defend Tibet, his homeland, when China took it over. And the Dalai Lama smiled with one of his beatific smiles and said, "So unfortunate that Tibet has no oil." And I think he's putting his finger on something that's very obvious. Now, I do think that the war in Iraq is unique in one way. I think it is the only war the United States ever fought without Americans understanding why we were fighting it. There have been other cases, such as in Vietnam, for example, when many Americans disagreed with the reasons why we were fighting, but at least we knew what the reasons were. In Iraq, I think if you go out on the street today and ask people, why are we fighting in Iraq, a lot of people wouldn't have a good answer. I know I don't. So what I do in my book when I'm trying to speculate on why we invaded Iraq is simply to say that a lot of people had a series of different reasons for wanting to do it, and I spend several pages listing what these various reasons were. They all overlapped. So some wanted to protect Israel. Some wanted to take pressure off Saudi Arabia. Some wanted to bring democracy to Iraq. Some wanted a platform in the Middle East from which the U.S. could project its political and economic and military power. Some wanted the oil that Iraq has. Others had their eyes on the huge multi-billion dollar reconstruction and infrastructure contract. So there were a whole host of reasons. And I think the administration has sort of shifted from one to the other and dropped some, like weapons of mass destruction, when they became unsustainable, and always jumped onto others. It's that confusion that has led Americans to the point where we don't even know why we are fighting there now.
No, it's still early in the game to rank order the overthrows, at least putting Iraq in that list in terms of their disastrous consequences for the United States and for the world, not to mention the country that gets overthrown. But looking at Iraq from what we know now, is it ranked as the most disastrous, or is Vietnam at the top of that list?
You know, it's a little bit self-centered always to think that the one you're closest to is the most important. But I really think that we are going to be paying for this Iraq invasion as long as anybody alive now is still alive. The repercussions of this have only begun to unfold. The fact that we have so empowered Iran, for example, what we did in Iraq, we overthrew Iran's worst enemy, Saddam Hussein. We basically liberated the entire Shiite community in Iraq, which is very Iran-oriented. And in the local elections that we've promoted, pro-Iranian figures have emerged almost everywhere. I think the possibility of conflict between Sunnis and Shiites exploding in Iraq and then spreading beyond the borders of Iraq into other countries is also a possibility in the future. Who knows how the Turks will respond when the Kurdish region of northern Iraq either becomes fully autonomous or independent. There are implications of this invasion that are still in the future, and I do believe that there will be books and books written about the terrible effects of this, and I think that in conclusion, we are going to realize that the effects of overthrowing Saddam were far worse for the world and for the United States than it would have been to leave him in power.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Stephen Kinzer, author of the brand new book, Overthrow: America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, published by Tom's Books. Just came out in April of 2006, soaring up the charts for good reason. It's an extraordinarily readable book. I read a lot of academic books for a living, and it's always a pleasure to read a book by a quality journalist. So I urge you to look at this book if you're interested in the subject. It also has, as Mr. Kinzer alluded to earlier, a number of photographs and reproductions in the book that really add quite a bit to it. So, again, the book is Overthrow by Stephen Kinzer, published by Times Books. You know, one of the defining moments for me coming of age as a young man was the Allende regime in Latin America. As I had been raised in a fairly conservative family, and I had been raised very much on the belief that the United States was a force for good in the world, and it was not an empire, and it would only intervene around the world to bring peace and truth and justice in the American way and all those good things. And so I was always confused. I had cognitive dissonance when the Allende regime came along, because here was a democratically elected government. Whether the United States liked it or not, it seemed like we should be happy to show our support for a regime that was democratic, to show that we were principled in the United States. And when we overthrew that regime, it sort of, as I said, threw me into a period of reevaluating my premises about the world. Talk a little bit about Chile, if you would.
The operation in Chile really falls into this broader pattern of American intervention. If President Salvador Allende had not nationalized, with the approval of the Chilean Congress, the Chilean holdings of the two big American copper companies, Kennecott and Anaconda, had he not challenged ITT and other American and American-affiliated companies working in Chile, he never would have been overthrown. That's what first brought Allende to the attention of the White House. Prominent American businessman with interests in Chile came to the White House and spoke directly to President Nixon, and that set the whole thing in motion. Then Nixon, as is often the case with presidents, transformed this from an intervention carried out for economic reasons to one carried out for political reasons. He believed that Allende was seeking not simply to reclaim his own country's natural resources, but that Allende had the long-term goal of somehow trying to subvert American power in the hemisphere. Now, as you said, Chile had a long tradition of democracy. Allende would certainly have been left office at the end of his term and been replaced probably with somebody more conservative, but the U.S. could not wait. This is another example of the impatience that drives American foreign policy. We're such a young country that I think we can accomplish whatever we want. We have this can-do mentality that's been very important to the development of America, but this can-do mentality can drag us into some very dangerous territory when it comes to overthrowing foreign governments. So President Allende was overthrown in 1973 in a coup in which the CIA was very deeply involved, and that coup resulted in his death. Now, you mentioned just a moment ago that in my book there are a number of photographs, and I assembled those painstakingly because I wanted them together to be seen as a kind of a little capsule graphic history of American overthrows of foreign governments. Most of those pictures were pretty easy to find and didn't cost much, but there were a couple that were quite expensive because they were only owned by one agency, and this agency realized what great pictures they were. One of them is the picture in my book that shows Secretary of State Henry Kissinger shaking hands with the military dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet, who he had helped to place in power. And they're both smiling at each other, and they give off this sense that we really worked this one out great, didn't we? So I needed to have that picture in my book because it really speaks volumes. And so even though the price was high, that was one I had to have. Just like the picture of Vice President George H.W. Bush with General Manuel Noriega, who he later overthrew. Bush, of course, had been head of the CIA. Noriega had been on the CIA payroll for 30 years. So that picture also is a symbol of how American foreign entanglements can go wrong. And in my picture section, I've tried to give a kind of a précis of my whole book, and that's why I needed to have those pictures in there.
Stephen Kinzer, one thing that occurred to me as I was reading about the overthrow of the Allende government in 1973 in Chile in your book was recent writings about the Venezuelan government under Hugo Chavez, democratically elected, and as far as I know, one of the most popular democratic regimes in the history of the region. And Chavez is very unpopular with the United States government for what would seem to be economic reasons, primarily, but not necessarily exclusively. And Thomas Friedman, who writes in the New York Times on foreign policy on a regular basis, has on at least two occasions in the last 6 months lumped Chavez's regime in with North Korea and a series of other rogue states, implying that this guy was really a threat to the stability of the world. And it seemed like it's part of a process of, again, demonizing what on paper seems like a fairly democratic regime.
Venezuela is an example of this resource curse that I've talked about in my book. If Venezuela didn't have any oil, or if President Chavez were not trying to change the terms on which Venezuela sells its oil, or if the United States was not such a voracious consumer of oil and didn't care so deeply about its price and where it's produced and under what conditions, then I don't think the U.S. would have much interest in Venezuela at all. So it's the oil thing that's really at the heart of this all. If it was just some populist in some South American country barking at Washington, that probably in itself wouldn't be enough to excite the wrath of the United States. Now, the U.S. has been very involved with the opposition in Venezuela. And at one point, there was a coup in Venezuela, as you know, and President Chavez actually was overthrown, but he managed to come back in a couple of days because the coup couldn't hold together. The U.S. was involved in a peripheral way in that coup, I think maybe a little bit too peripheral for it to be successful. Now we are seeing this populist tendency that is epitomized by President Chavez spreading to other countries. Latin America is probably the continent that is in the most open rebellion now against American policies. That also happens to be the continent where the U.S. has intervened most often over the longest period of time. That cannot be a coincidence. To give just one example, the latest member of this club of populist leaders in Latin America is Evo Morales, the new president of Bolivia. Now, Bolivia is also a country rich in natural resources, in particular gas, and that's why his defiance is very troubling to the U.S. Now, when President Morales gave his inaugural address a couple of months ago, he spoke to a large crowd outdoors in the main square in La Paz, and in the middle of his speech, he stopped and said that he wanted to ask for a moment of silence to honor the memory of Che Guevara, who, of course, was a longtime anti-American fighter in South America. President Morales himself came to office and won a landslide victory at the polls by promising that he would be, quote, America's worst nightmare. To me, it shows how far we have fallen in the world, that the way to get elected overwhelmingly in a democratic election in Latin America is to promise that you'll be America's worst nightmare. That shows to me how much resistance builds up after long periods of American intervention.
Well, in the shoes of the President of the United States or the head of the CIA or the State Department trying to deal with the Evo Morales and Hugo Chavez's of the world, it seems to me, reading your book, that the plausibility of a land invasion a la Iraq is simply would be counterproductive.
I do think that would-be interveners and overthrowers in Washington now are a little bit perplexed. If there is one positive outcome of the Iraq invasion, it might be that Americans are a little less reluctant. I'm sorry, a little less willing, a little more reluctant to get involved in these kinds of interventions, and that makes it more difficult for policymakers to drum up political support for it. As for using the CIA as we used it in the past, unfortunately, at least for the CIA, many leaders in foreign countries have become very familiar with the way the CIA operates. They are not so vulnerable as they used to be. This takes me back to another episode that happened right after the coup in Guatemala, and one that I think had a huge influence on Latin American history. So the U.S. overthrew the government of Guatemala in 1954. At that time, there were a number of people from other Latin American countries who had come to Guatemala to watch what was happening, this kind of interesting social democratic experiment. One of those was a young Argentine doctor named Che Guevara. He was actually in Guatemala on the day that the U.S. overthrew President Arbenz. He had to flee into the Mexican embassy. Finally, he was allowed to leave. He went to Mexico, and there he met Fidel Castro, who was plotting his revolution in Cuba. So Castro was fascinated about what happened in Guatemala, and he wanted to hear from Che Guevara what happened. And this is what Che told him in a number of very long all-night conversations. Essentially, this is what he said. President Arbenz in Guatemala made one crucial mistake. He tried to impose a program of social reform within the framework of democracy. He allowed the opposition parties to function. He allowed the opposition press to function. There were all kinds of different factors in civil society and unions and student groups and so forth. Now, the CIA came in and used those democratic freedoms to overthrow Arbenz. They bribed the members of Congress. They made contacts with the military. Manipulated the Guatemalan press. So Che Guevara told Castro, the lesson is, when we take over in Cuba, immediately declare a dictatorship. Close down the opposition press, abolish the Constitution, close the Congress, don't allow any trade unions or any independent student groups. That, because if we try to do it within democracy, the Americans will come in and crush us. So we can only transform our society if we do it with dictatorship. This was the lesson that the U.S. taught a whole generation of rising leaders in Latin America. And that is what has contributed to a lot of the suffering that Latin Americans have gone through over these last decades.
That's an extraordinary story. And I recall from someone else I know who was in Chile in 1971 when Castro came to visit Allende, the first trip he'd ever made to South America. He basically gave that same conversation to Allende, saying, you know, you're dreaming if you think you can follow constitutional rule and up and have the U.S. overthrow you.
And what happened? Allende told him, you're crazy. Chile has always been a democracy. It's the only way to operate here.
Yeah.
And the result was just what Castro had predicted. The U.S. came in and overthrew him.
Our guest, Stephen Kinzer, author of Overthrow America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, just out from Times Books. We're talking about it today. The show is pre-recorded by a couple weeks from when we go on air, so please don't call in the remaining 5 minutes or so. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show as much as we can. It is a depressing book in many ways, though enlightening. As I said earlier, as we look forward and there's Iran and South Korea and Venezuela and all sorts of other countries sort of being lined up for demonization and possible overthrow, what lessons, I mean, where do we go from here? How do we get out of this pattern that we've had of the last 100 years?
It's very interesting that you should ask me that question because I have been pondering it myself now. I've been writing books about the terrible effects of American intervention for a long time. So I've written this book, Overthrow. Before this, I wrote a book about how the U.S. overthrew the government of Iran. I've written about how the U.S. overthrew the government of Guatemala. That was another book, and Nicaragua also. So I've gotten to be an expert on how bad these interventions turn out and what great mistakes they are. But that begs the question, which I think is really an urgent one in the world today, that you are asking. There are going to be future interventions. That's for sure. And the United States will be an intervening country just because of its position in the world. That's inevitable. There are even places in the world that are crying out for intervention. We look at Darfur in Africa, or in the past, like Bosnia or Kosovo. Now, how do we do it right? I've gotten to be an expert on how to do it wrong. But how do we do it right, considering the fact that these operations are probably going to be launched in the future? How can we do it in a way that will be positive? I don't know the answer to that question, but I want to write my next book about it, and I will leave in a few days for Rwanda, which is going to be the place where I'm going to set my book. But although it will be set in Rwanda, it won't really be about Rwanda. It will be using that country as an example to answer this question. What's the right way to do it? How can the world intervene to stop great tragedies from unfolding, but in a way that produces positive results rather than the disasters of our past interventions?
Stephen Kinzer, we've talked already about some of the problems the U.S. news media have had covering U.S. overthrows and U.S. foreign policy over the past 100 years, not just with the Iraq invasion of 2003. Many of my listeners often ask, you know, where should we go to get reliable information? How can we get information before the invasion, before the overthrow, so as citizens we can actually know what's going on if we can't rely on conventional news media to do an effective job? Where would you tell people to go to try to stay on top of world politics with, if not maybe a more objective voice, at least a more accurate picture of what's going on?
I do think that the American press really fell down on the job in the run-up to the Iraq War. It was a very distressing experience for me and was part of the reason why I finally decided that I would break out of the prison of objectivity by leaving the daily newspaper business. I think that the Internet has democratized access to information quite a bit. And although there's a lot of junk out there, there's also a lot of very interesting stuff. There's stuff that's has not been available to Americans in the past. So I would advise people to tune in to some media programs that regularly cover these events, like Democracy Now!, and then to try to follow favorite Internet sites that might cover particular parts of the world and try to penetrate behind the fog of misinformation that not only envelops Washington, but much of the American press.
So your next book, Stephen Kinzer, is going to be on hopefully the best way to do an overthrow?
Yeah. What I want to ask myself is, for example, using Rwanda as an example, so 800,000 people were massacred there in the space of just a few months. The world sat by and didn't do anything. Why? What could it have done? What should it have done? What should we do in the future when these kinds of tragedies emerge? How can we respond to them? I can't avoid asking myself those questions, just as you couldn't avoid asking it to me.
And you know what? On that note, I'm going to say we will have you as a guest here when that book is written, because it will be wonderful to hear what you've discovered and writing about. But right now, unfortunately, we're out of time on Media Matters. So Stephen Kinzer, author of Overthrow, thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 1 week from today.